And welcome to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. Welcome to the show. So before we get into today's content, we'll start with some music. And I found this great tune by the Handsome Family called The Bottomless Hole, about a hole in the back of some guy's barn. It's quite humorous. And he's never sure whether it's bottomless or not. So that's from the Handsome Family's album Singing Bones from 2003. So here it is, The Bottomless Hole.
My name I don't remember, though I hail from Ohio. I had a wife and children, good tires on my car. What took me from my home and put me in the earth was the mouth of a deep dark hole I found behind my scraps and dead cows, tractors broken down. But never did I hear one thing hit the ground. And slowly I came to fear that this was a bottomless hole. I went out behind the bar and stared down in that hole. Laying into the evening, my mind would not let go. So I got out my ropes and a rusty clawfoot tub, and I rigged myself a chariot to ride down in.
And that was The Bottomless Hole by the Handsome Family from their 2003 album, Singing Bones. So we have a great show for you today. We are going to feature something from Democracy Now! First. So it's actually two kind of stories, one after the other, on Democracy Now! And it's an interview with Nick Estes, who is a historian and co-founder of the Red Nation. And the first story is about how the U.S. Interior Department has documented the deaths of more than 500 indigenous children at Indian boarding schools in the U.S. that were run or supported by the federal government and operated from 1819 to 1969. So very similar to the Canadian situation with residential schools. And this is about the same situation in the U.S. And then right after that, writer and activist Nick Estes continues to talk about Indigenous rights issues, and in particular, the fact that calls are growing for President Biden to grant clemency to Leonard Peltier, who is the 77-year-old imprisoned Native American activist who has spent 46 years behind bars for a crime he did not commit. So here are these stories from Democracy Now!
A new report by the Interior Department has documented the deaths of 500 Indigenous children at Indian boarding schools, runners supported by the federal government in the United States, but the actual death toll is believed to be far higher. The report also located 53 burial sites at former schools, which were run for over a century. The report marks the first time the Department of Interior has documented some of the horrific history of the schools, known for their brutal assimilation practices, forcing students to change their clothing, language, and culture. The report was ordered by Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, who is a member of the Laguna Pueblo. Her grandparents were forced to attend boarding school at the age of 8. She spoke on Wednesday.
For more than a century, tens of thousands of Indigenous children were taken from their communities and forced into boarding schools run by the U.S. government, specifically the Department of the Interior and religious institutions. When my maternal grandparents were only 8 years old, they were stolen from their parents' culture and communities and forced to live in boarding schools until the age of 13. Many children like them never made it back to their homes. The federal policies that attempted to wipe out Native identity, language, and culture continue to manifest in the pain tribal communities face today, including cycles of violence and abuse, disappearance of Indigenous people, premature deaths, poverty and loss of wealth, mental health disorders, and substance abuse. Recognizing the impacts of the federal Indian boarding school system cannot just be a historical reckoning. We must also chart a path forward to deal with these legacy issues. The fact that I am standing here today as the first Indigenous Cabinet Secretary is testament to the strength and determination of Native people. I am here because my ancestors persevered. I stand on the shoulders of my grandmother and my mother. And the work we will do with the Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative will have a transformational impact on the generations who follow.
That was Interior Secretary Deb Haaland. On Thursday, Matthew Warbonnet, who was brought to a boarding school on the Rosebud Sioux Indian Reservation in South Dakota at the age of 6, testified about his experience before the House Subcommittee for Indigenous Peoples.
My boarding school experience is very painful and traumatic. I remember when I first got to school, the priest took us to his big room, which had 6 or 8 bathtubs in it. The priest took all us little guys and put us in one tub, and he scrubbed us hard with a big brush. The brush made our skins and our backsides all raw. Then we had to have our hair cut. The school then put all the little guys in the same dormitory. We were together the first through fourth grades. At night time, you could hear all the children crying.
To talk more about the history of Indian boarding schools, runners supported by the U.S. government, we're joined by Nick Estes in Minneapolis, writer, historian, author of the book Our History is the Future, Standing Rock versus the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Long Tradition of Indigenous Resistance. He's co-founder of the Indigenous Resistance Group, the Red Nation, and a citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe. Nick, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about the significance of this new Interior Department report.
Thanks so much for having me, Amy. And as you could hear in the voices of the people, Secretary Haaland, this is a very emotional experience for a lot of Indigenous people in this country, and it should be an emotional experience for non-Indigenous people in this country. This is quite a historic moment in time. Although it's not new news to Indigenous people, it might be new news to those who are hearing this horrific genocidal process that has taken place. I think You know, there's a reason why the forcibly transferring of children from one group to another group is an international legal definition of genocide. That's what we're talking about, because taking children or the process of Indian child removal has been one strategy for terrorizing Native families for centuries. From the mass removal of Native children from their communities into boarding schools, as this new report lays out, from their communities into, you know, their widespread adoption and fostering out to mostly white families, which happened primarily in the 20th century. This is you know, a historic report in that regard, because it documents, I think, for the first time, the federal government admitting to this genocidal process. Of course, they don't use that language in this report, but many of the researchers, most of whom were Indigenous, who did the legwork on this first volume, I think it's going to be the first volume of several volumes, to say that this is a widespread, this was a widespread systematic destruction, not just of our culture, but of our nations, as well as an open, you know, theft of land. And I think that's important to talk about here, that settler colonialism isn't just about targeting Native people because they hate our culture, our language, or our religion. But this boarding school system came at a time when the United States government, at the turn of the 19th century to the 20th century, was looking to consolidate its Western frontier through the Dawes Allotment Act, which resulted in, you know, hundreds of millions of acres of Indian territory being opened up for white settlement, and using Indian children as hostages. And that's the language of the policy reformers at the time. That's the language that they were using. They were saying, we are going to use these children as hostages for the quote-unquote good behavior of their people.
Now, you have visited and reported on one particular Indian boarding school, the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, that was opened in 1879. Can you talk about that as an example of what took place around this country?
Carlisle really became the archetype of off-reservation Indian boarding schools. And in fact, the Carlisle Indian School, the first classes that entered were from Lakota people, my nation, from specifically the Pine Ridge and Rosebud agencies, because we had put up historic resistance against the Dawes Allotment Act. And it was a way to essentially break the tribal bonds of our people. And so that first class that went, it's documented in Luther Standing Bear's two autobiographies that he wrote. He's from the Rosebud Sioux tribe. And he talks about these schools as not being so much schools, but as prisoner of war camps, where they didn't learn, you know, the ABCs or, you know, language and mathematics, the things that you would expect to learn at schools. Instead, they learned military discipline, because, you know, General Pratt, or Colonel Pratt, he was a military man. And this was a strange arrangement between the U.S. military and the Department of Interior to run this off-reservation boarding school. But the militarized discipline became instilled in many of the off-reservation boarding schools, as well as the inculcation of U.S. patriotism, flag worship, and religious obedience. And so the first classes that went to the Carlisle Indian School, according to the testimony of Luther Standing Bear, who was part of that first incoming class, half of them didn't even return home. Many of them died at that school. So it's kind of a misnomer to actually call these educational institutions or schools themselves when you didn't have very many people graduating, let alone surviving the dire conditions of those schools. And in this report, they document the forced labor, the unpaid labor of Native children was used to essentially subsidize the lack of resources that the federal government was not providing to Indian education at this time, too. So it was a horrific experience for those of, you know, for those who didn't make it out, but it was also a horrific experience for those who did make it out. And to this day, at the entrance of the Carlisle Indian School, there's a cemetery of hundreds of gravestones. And many tribal nations, including the Rosebud Sioux tribe, have been working on returning their ancestors. Some of them have been successful, but it's also important to point out that some of the children that died there are from tribal nations that don't, you know, that have protocols around not disturbing, you know, their ancestors when they're interred in the, into the earth. And so this is a very delicate situation. It's not just the problem of the federal government. It's also the problem of the U.S. military.
So
because
let me
this
ask...
is an active, it's an active military base. I think that's important to point out, too.
Nick Estes, research by Preston McBride at Dartmouth, Dartmouth College, has suggested as many as 40,000 Native American children died at government-run boarding schools around the U.S. This report is saying 500. Can you talk more about this discrepancy?
Yeah, I think in the press briefing by the Department of Interior yesterday, it was pointed out by Deb Holland as well as Assistant Secretary Brian Newland that this was a preliminary report and that they've identified over 53 marked or unmarked grave sites at these various off-reservation boarding schools and on-reservation boarding schools. And I think it's a really delicate matter because, you know, for example, the Rapid City Indian School, which is, you know, in Rapid City, South Dakota, the burial sites are actually within the community itself. There have been housing projects that have been built over the burial sites, and a lot of people are reluctant to identify them publicly because of the history of grave robbing at a lot of these sites. And so I think, you know, what Preston is saying is very true, that this isn't undercount because it's an initial survey of these specific grave sites. But I think as this investigation goes underway and more documents become, you know, available for the public, we're going to see those numbers continue to rise. And it's very tragic. I think it's important to point out that this initiative began last June when, you know, several hundred Native children's graves were found in Canada. But where are the headlines now about all the, you know, the surveys that a lot of these First Nations are doing at these sites? And the numbers are in the thousands right now, but it's not making headlines, you know? And so I think it's important to pay attention to this as it unfolds and to really listen to a lot of the Native elders, as well as the Native researchers who have been doing this historically. This isn't new news to us, you know. We don't have a definitive number. All we have is the common experience of the boarding school system as it has affected every single American Indian in this country.
Do you have reservations about the report? In fact, it's true the Interior Department report said they expect to find thousands, if not tens of thousands, of deaths. But you're talking about a report that was released by the Interior Department and worked on by the Bureau of Indian Affairs within that, which actually ran the whole boarding school system. But the new development, of course, is Deb Holland is in charge, the first Native American cabinet member in U.S. history.
Yeah, I think it's important to point out that, you know, Deb Holland is, you know, I think she's been in this position for just over a year now. And 1 year is, you know, in the face of, you know, a century and a half of genocidal Indian policy, isn't that much, you know, when we think about how these, you know, how history unfolds. But also, I think it's important to point out that the perpetrator of this crime against humanity is now going to be the adjudicator of justice, so to speak. And there were questions of Deb Holland's office yesterday about what reparations will look like on behalf of tribes. They're modeling their truth and reconciliation process off of the Canadian model. But it's important to point out that the Canadian Truth and Reconciliation Commission only came about because of a class action lawsuit on behalf of residential school survivors. And I would say that the Department of Interior has a poor track record in terms of, you know, adjudicating and accounting for its own crimes. You know, we can look at the Cole Bell settlement, which happened in 2011. The banker, Eloise Cole Bell, she was from the Blackfoot Nation. She did a forensic audit of, you know, the United States, and found that the federal government had mismanaged $176 billion of individual Indian monies. And the Department of Interior awarded itself, because we're still considered wards of the government, $3.5 billion. That's, you know, almost pennies on the dollar of what she had accounted for in terms of damages that we were awarded. And so, you know, it's no coincidence that Indian people are in the same department that manages wildlife and federal lands. You know, we have, I heard earlier in the broadcast that the Department of Interior is kind of going back on this, overt federal leasing program, you know, but it's not just the question of Indian boarding schools. It's all, you know, because Indian boarding schools were one facet of a larger, you know, process of dispossession and theft of indigenous, you know, people's lands and resources, because the Indian boarding school system was actually using treaty annuities and federal funds that was meant for Indian education for this genocidal process. And this money was gained through the selling of our land to white settlers. It was also gained through the dispossession of those lands by the federal government itself. And so there's a lot of accounting to be done here. And, you know, the report itself identifies 39,000 boxes of materials that the federal government has. I think it's about over 9 million pages of documents that need to be reviewed. And so allocating just $7 million to this investigative process over a century and a half of genocidal policies is kind of a drop in the bucket in what needs to happen. And I think, but it is important to point out that there is, you know, there is Representative Sharice Davis, who's a Democrat from Kansas and also from an Indigenous nation herself, has a bill that's going through Congress right now that'll open up, I think, more federal money for an investigative process that'll look not only into the federal Indian boarding school system, but also look into the role of faith groups, specifically the Catholic Church, and its role in these genocidal educational policies.
Well, we will certainly continue to follow all of this. But Nick Estes, before we end, I wanted to ask you about Leonard Peltier, the 77-year-old Anishinaabe Lakota Native American activist who's been in prison for 46 years for a crime he says he did not commit. Leonard Peltier was a member of the American Indian Movement, convicted of involvement in the killing of two FBI agents in a shootout on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota in 1975. His arrest and trial, marred by prosecutorial misconduct, withheld evidence, coerced and fabricated eyewitness testimony, and more. Amnesty International has long called him a political prisoner. In late April, Hawaii Senator Brian Schatz asked Attorney General Merrick Garland about calls to grant Peltier clemency.
Final question, easy one. What is your position on clemency for Leonard Peltier?
So this is a matter that goes into applications, go to the pardon attorney. Pardon attorney makes recommendations through the Deputy Attorney General to the president. And so I'm not going to comment on that now. So,
can you comment on where we are in the process?
I assume, but don't know, that an application has been made. I actually don't even know whether—I mean, I've read about this in the press, so I don't know anything more about it than what I've read in the press.
And this doesn't cross your desk?
Certainly not as an initial or even secondary matter. This goes to the pardon attorney and then the deputy attorney general. I'm not saying I wouldn't be involved, but it certainly has not crossed my desk.
Thank you very much.
Nick Estes, can you talk about Leonard Peltier? You recently co-wrote a piece for The Guardian headlined, "Leonard Peltier is America's longest-held Indigenous prisoner. He should be freed."
Yeah, it's important to point out, first of all, Leonard Peltier is a product of this federal Indian boarding school system. His name was actually mentioned in the press conference yesterday on this particular initiative. And in fact, it's also important to point out that during her tenure as a congresswoman for New Mexico, Deb Haaland was a strident advocate for Leonard Peltier's release. And so we're seeing a growing momentum around the question of Leonard Peltier's continued unjust imprisonment. And, you know, the Obama administration had an opportunity to correct the course of, you know, history in releasing, you know, Leonard Peltier, granting him clemency, because that's the only option on the table right now for his release. But he is an elder. He's an endeared elder to his community. Turtle Mountain Ojibwe have a plan in place so that once he is released, he has housing and he's taken in by the community itself. You have a representative, Ruth Buffalo, from North Dakota, who's up for re-election this year, who's been a strident advocate for Leonard Peltier, who talks to Leonard Peltier on a weekly basis. And so you have this massive support from Indian country, from elected officials to tribal governments advocating for his release. And if we want true justice in this country, whether it's for the boarding school system, something that Leonard Peltier himself was fighting against as part of the American Indian movement, then we also need to, you know, not only advocate for his release, but advocate for a full congressional investigation into the conditions that led to the shootout at the Jumping Bull property in 1975, and the multiple, the tens, you know, the dozens of deaths that have gone unsolved on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation during the so-called Reign of Terror following the occupation of Wounded Knee in 1973. And so this is an open wound for Indian country, and it's an open wound for the federal government. And his committee is advocating for healing. And the first step of that process is to grant him clemency. At this point, there's no reason other than, vindictive revenge for him to be in prison. He survived COVID. He's in poor health. And the man deserves to be with his people.
Why don't we end with Leonard Peltier's voice? By the way, his new attorney is a former chief judge from Tennessee. But I spoke to Leonard, 10 years ago. That's this clip on the phone in a Florida prison.
Leonard, this is Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! I was
wondering.
Hi, I'm good. I was wondering if you have a message for President Obama.
I just hope he can, the wars that are going on in the world and stuff, getting killing all those people, getting killed, and give the Black Hills back to my people, and turn me loose.
Can you share with people at the news conference and with President Obama your case for why your sentence should be commuted, why you want clemency?
Wouldn't allow me to put up a defense, and manufactured evidence, manufactured witnesses, tortured witnesses. The list just goes on. So I think I'm a very good candidate for, after 37 years, for clemency, or house arrest, at least.
I was speaking to Leonard Peltier at a public forum a day after a major event at the Beacon Theater had taken place in his honor and to raise money for his support here in New York City. Well, Nick Estes, we thank you for being with us. Writer, historian, author of Our History is the Future, Standing Rock versus the Dakota Access Pipeline, long tradition of indigenous resistance, co-founder of Red Nation. You can link to all of our interviews with Leonard Peltier, as well as my questioning of President Clinton at the time, whether he would be granting clemency. And you hear Leonard Peltier himself talking about asking President Obama for that. Now the question is, what will President Biden and Attorney General Merrick Garland do?
And that was a story from Democracy Now! About the calls that are growing for President Biden to grant clemency to Leonard Peltier, the 77-year-old imprisoned indigenous American activist who has spent 46 years behind bars for a crime that he says he did not commit. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. So we're going to feature a talk from Idea City. And what is Idea City? Idea City was founded by the media icon Moses Neimer and features over 20 years of adventure, discovery, innovation, and some of the brightest minds on the planet. You can check them out by going to their YouTube channel, which is Idea City. And in 2017, I believe, the award-winning Canadian author Francis Backhouse was a guest, or was asked to give a talk about her book, Once They Were Hats, In Search of the Mighty Beaver, which the Globe and Mail called one of 20 books that you'll be reading and talking about for the rest of the year. And she is a former biologist, Frances Backhouse, and she wrote this book in 2015. And beavers are interesting, of course. I've always been a big fan of beavers. They're an animal that is considered a keystone species. She might mention that in her talk, I think. It means that they really create habitats for all these other species. So when they dam a river or a stream and build a pond or create a pond by this activity, immediately that becomes spawning habitat or breeding habitat for fish, for frogs, for salamanders, for aquatic insects. Then water birds of different kinds will come in, so be it herons, ducks, geese, rails, terns, all kinds of different species. And of course, animals like moose benefit from aquatic environments like that because they feed on the aquatic plants in beaver ponds. And otters will colonize the area, perhaps. So you see how it just goes on and on and on. The amount of good things that beavers bring to an ecosystem when they create these dams and then create water or flooding, which floods areas which were previously not flooded, really has an amazing impact on the ecosystem. So I think it's an amazing animal, and they really have made a comeback. So out where I live in St. Anne de Bellevue, there's some in Lac St. Louis, there's some in Lake of Two Mountains, there's some in the Riviera Lorme, which is the river that's partly in Pierrefonds and partly in St. Anne de Bellevue. And there you find beaver lodges, beaver dams. So even in the Morgan Arboretum, there's been times when there's been an active beaver pond. So they've made a comeback, and, they're a species that that create amazing habitat for other animals. And that's why we call them a keystone species. And of course, they were very much featured in the early part of Canadian history because of the fur trade and so on. So here is that talk from Idea City with Frances Backhouse about her book, Once They Were Hats, In Search of the Mighty Beaver.
Okay, on this very stage, Preston Manning said, Canada is the only country in the world that owes its foundation, its very existence, to the undue exploitation of a rodent. That's probably true, but not as dignified as I might have hoped, so we have asked the world's foremost scholar and scientist and investigator into the beaver, Frances Backhouse, to come out here and tell us more about this noble creature.
So, beavers. When I first started working on this book, I was actually sometimes reluctant to tell people what I was actually writing about. Not because of that other meaning of the word beaver, I got used to the jokes, but because I was afraid that maybe beavers were kind of boring, at least to anyone other than binocular-toting naturalist geeks like me. I'm happy to say that by the time I finished working on the book, all those doubts were gone. I was a true beaver believer. I went searching in search of Castor canadensis, and I found what I came to think of as the mighty beaver, an incredible animal that has had a profound effect on this continent for 1 million years and still has a lot to offer us, which it makes it sobering to think that we actually almost annihilated this species. However, for a long time, we didn't really realize how much we stood to lose. As a society, we were suffering from a bad case of ecological amnesia, not just You don't know what you've got till it's gone. We had forgotten what we had and why beavers matter. So I'm going to go back and start with the before picture. In 1497, when John Cabot set foot on what we now call Newfoundland, stepped ashore and kicked off the European invasion of North America, beavers were one of the most abundant and most widespread animals in North America. Their range extended from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific, from just south of the Rio Grande River, all the way up to the northern tree line. With a few exceptions, wherever there was wood and water, there were beavers, which meant there were a lot of them. The most conservative estimate of the number of beavers prior to Europeans coming to North America is 60 million, and the high-end estimate is 400 million. Fast forward a few centuries, and you would have been hard-pressed to find a beaver anywhere in North America. To give you a sense of the scarcity, I'm going to tell you a little bit story about this image, which is on the cover of my book. Now, some of you might recognize it as the work of the great American naturalist and wildlife artist John James Audubon. And if you do, you might wonder why the beavers are a little odd-looking. Well, in 1843, Audubon went on a journey to collect specimens and take notes for what would be his last great work, an illustrated book about the mammals of North America. He traveled up the Missouri River spent 8 months traveling up the Missouri River, 3,000 kilometers, and got most of what he was looking for, with one exception. Although he had the assistance of a skilled trapper, he failed to see a single beaver in that eight-month period, let alone catch one. And as far as I know, he never did get hold of a live beaver to use as a model for his painting. There would have been no point looking in eastern North America because by then beavers were gone from all of the eastern states, most of eastern Canada, and the trappers were well on their way to cleaning out beavers in the western half of the continent. So by 1900, the North American beaver population had nosedived to an all-time low. Now, we don't know exactly how many survivors there were, but the best guess is that it was in the low 100,000s. So less than 1% of the most conservative estimate of the pre-European contact population. The scale of this slaughter came about because the fur trade was North America's first gold rush, and beaver pelts were the gold, literally the coin of the realm, for a large part of the early colonial period. When Europeans arrived in North America, the hottest fashion item back home was hats made out of felted beaver fur. And as a result of demand for these hats, the Europeans had decimated their own beaver population. It took 2 to 3 pelts to make a good quality top hat. And now here they had arrived on a continent that was swarming with beavers. So the fur trade started on the East Coast and steamrolled across the continent, obliterating every beaver colony in its path. By the time we were headed into the 20th century, the general consensus was beavers were headed for extinction. So not everyone believed that. There were a few people who still held out hope for the beaver and began working to try to save the species. And one of the most famous of those people was a man named Archibald Bellany, who moved to Canada in 1906, changed his name to Grey Owl, and reinvented himself as an Indian. Besides being a cultural imposter, he was also a serial bigamist, a negligent father, an alcoholic. But his redeeming quality, at least in my opinion, was he was a great promoter of beaver conservation. And through his efforts and the efforts of less famous beaver advocates, governments were convinced to implement trapping regulations and then to start reintroducing beavers to places from which they'd been exterminated. And this worked. Beaver populations started to rebound. They began to spread out and reclaim their old territory. And this became one of North America's greatest conservation success stories. Beavers have now come back to almost all of their historic range. They're even in big cities like New York and here in Toronto. And they're doing reasonably well. It's hard to count beavers. The current estimate is that the population is between 10 million and 50 million. Okay, so I imagine at least one person out there is thinking, 50 million beavers? That's not a success story, that's a horror story. The invasion of the dam builders. And that's an understandable reaction. They're formidable adversaries when their interests are not in sync with ours. When they're blocking up culverts and flooding your roads or your farm fields, when they're cutting down all the beautiful old trees in your local park, or, God forbid, fatally attacking your dog in an off-leash area, which has happened. Some years ago, in 2011, Senator Nicole Eaton actually launched a campaign to fire the beaver as our national animal. She called beavers dentally defective rats and toothy tyrants that wreak havoc all over the place. Okay, harsh words, but as I say, I understand how that thinking comes about. Beavers can cut down almost any size of tree. The largest tree that's ever been found cut by a beaver was about a meter in diameter. They can build huge dams. The historical record comes from the journals of the mapmaker David Thompson, who was traveling across the prairies in the late 1700s and found a beaver dam that was a mile long and wide enough for two horses to cross it walking side by side. So imagine that. The current record holder is only about half a mile long, but they're working on it. So, toothy tyrants, I prefer to think of them as faunal philanthropists. And it turns out that humans are one of the major beneficiaries of their philanthropy. As beaver populations come back, biologists are finally able to really study them properly, and we're getting more and more proof that this is a species that punches well above its weight in terms of ecological impact. I'm going to talk about four ways that beavers make our world a better place. To start with, they create critical habitat for a multitude of species. Now, they're not intentional altruists, but by creating the habitat that they need for themselves, they increase the supply of a highly desirable and relatively rare type of natural real estate, namely wetlands. So beaver ponds and those squelchy, swampy edges around them are biodiversity hotspots that teem with life. Dragonflies, tadpoles, fish, turtles, ducks and herons and swallows, mink and moose that you're going to hear about more about later. These are entire complex communities that are contingent on the presence of one keystone species, the beaver. Second beaver benefit, erosion control. Now, when they dam rivers or creeks, they don't stop the water, but they slow it down. And this has two effects. Sediments build up behind the dam, and there's less channel scouring downstream. An example of how this can be beneficial comes from Wyoming, where beavers were introduced to a very badly erosion-damaged stream. Before they came back, the stream was carrying away 33 tons of silt a day. With the beaver dams in place, that dropped to 4 tons of silt a day, so a 90% decrease in the erosion. And not only were they stopping the damage from continuing, they began to heal the land. The undammed river was like a knife that was slicing down through the ground and leaving the plants on the banks high and dry. With the dams in place, the river channel built up, the water was elevated, and it could flow out laterally and feed the groundwater system. So there was a higher water table, more trees and shrubs, and more birds. Third thing is pollution control. Specifically, beavers excel at nitrogen busting. So all over North America, septic systems and fertilizer runoff are pumping nitrogen into creeks and rivers. That goes downstream, and it becomes particularly problematic where in coastal areas where it feeds massive algae blooms, which suck up oxygen and kill off fish. Recently, a team of researchers from New York found that bacteria in the bottom of beaver ponds can remove up to 45% of the nitrogen from the pond water. So with beavers on the job, there's less nitrogen flowing downstream, and we have healthier coastal ecosystems. And lastly, beavers are outstanding water stewards. They help mitigate against flooding and drought, which are both becoming more frequent and more severe in this time of climate change. So when there's heavy rainfall or rapid snow melt, beaver ponds hold the water in place. It can be released more slowly instead of flowing downstream in a torrent. Same thing works with drought. And some of the best evidence here comes from a study that was done in the aptly named Beaver Hills of Alberta by Glynis Hood, who was actually on the stage talking about beavers in 2011. She found that ponds that have beavers in them hold more water than ponds without beavers. An incredible 9 times greater surface water area in the ponds with beavers than in the beaverless ponds. And it's not just the visible water, it's also the groundwater. So another scientist, a hydrologist named Sherry Westbrook, took me out to one of her study sites and showed me where a large pond was raising the groundwater, the water table, for a couple of square kilometers around that pond and keeping a whole valley moist through the dry months of summer. What all this tells us is that beavers can be terrific allies. They can help us nurture biodiversity, combat erosion and pollution, and cope with some of the effects of climate change. As we're getting reacquainted with beavers, we're also learning how better to live with them, how to coexist rather than clashing with them. I don't have time to go into all of that, but you can look up things like beaver deceivers, beaver bafflers, pond levelers, their flood control devices. We can wrap wire mesh around trees. There are ways to live with beavers. So I began with a before picture of a continent that was filled with beavers from coast to coast. And I'm very glad that I don't have to end with an after picture of a continent littered with broken beaver dams and dried up beaver ponds, which is the way it was in 1900. We've come a long way in the last 100 or so years. In 1892, the author of the first ever book about beavers, Castrologia, a man named Horace T. Martin, he was really pessimistic about the prospects of his subject. He wrote, "As to the ultimate destruction of the beaver, there can be no possible question." So no pulling punches, he was convinced beavers were doomed. Here's another quote from Martin. "It's kind of a rallying cry to resist the ecological amnesia that was already taking hold. So a traditional knowledge of the beaver is the birthright of every Canadian." He thought that future Canadians would only be able to learn about beavers from books like his because the animals themselves would be gone. And I think he would be delighted to know how wrong he was about that. Beavers did survive, and our knowledge of them keeps on growing. And the more we learn about them, the more obvious it is that Castor canadensis is an amazing animal that deserves our admiration, our respect, our protection. Keystone habitat creator, ecosystem engineer, water steward, climate change ally, let's hear it for the mighty beaver. Thank you.
And that was Frances Backhouse speaking at the 2017 Idea City conference. And she was talking about her book, Once They Were Hats, In Search of the Mighty Beaver, which was published in 2015. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. We're basically out of time, so thanks for listening to the show. And you can always follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/EquilibriumCKUTMontreal. You can email us with comments and suggestions at equilibrium@CKUT.ca. And we have a little website, which is equilibriumradio.weebly.com. And there you can find a link to our SoundCloud page, which has some of our best interviews. And we do have a podcast as well on Spotify, which you can find, which is called the Equilibrium Radio Podcast. So my name is Ryan Young. Thanks for listening to the show. We're going to leave you with some music. And Hair, of course, was a great musical. And there was a great song in the Hair musical, which was the song Aquarius. And many people say we are now entering the age of Aquarius. So I've been tempted to play this version of Aquarius from the Hair musical. And this is from the special anniversary edition, which was a remastered original cast recording. And this came out in 1979. And it features Galt McDermott and Tom Pearson. So here is Aquarius. Have a great rest of your day.
Black Rose Books invites you to our book launch event,
Confronting Canada's Past and Europe's Forgotten Revolutions,
happening on Sunday, May 22nd, featuring the authors and editors of
Stand on Guard for Whom?
The Fire That Time,
Insatiable Hunger,
The Forgotten Revolution,
and Black Ukraine Yesterday and Today.
Join us on live stream or in person at 2 p.m.
at the Cité des Hospitalières, 251 Pine West, Corner Park.
Free tickets are available at blackroselaunch.eventbrite.ca or visit blackrosebooks.com for more information.
This event is co-presented with the Cité des Hospitalières en Transition and CKUT-FM.
The 7th Annual Old School Bluegrass Camp is happening this July in the beautiful Lanark Highlands of Ontario. Old School Bluegrass Camp is a summer camp for grown-ups. At camp, you'll enjoy band labs, bonfire jams, exclusive evening concerts, fresh farm-to-table meals, and world-class instruction from some of bluegrass and old time's brightest stars. So come to camp and connect with your community, find your people, and meet your new best friends. Details at oldschoolbluegrasscamp.wordpress.com.
Through Tree Canada's National Greening Program, native tree seedlings are planted across Canada, creating a widespread impact. Planted trees provide habitat, prevent soil erosion, and reforest areas that have suffered tree loss due to pests and weather. Tree Canada performs 1, 2, and 5-year assessments to monitor tree survival and ensure the trees planted are on track to meet the forest cover goals of the site. To learn more or to get involved, go to treecanada.ca.
Whose data? Our data. When you're not paying for a product, you are the product. Especially in web and email services, where multinationals compete to manage your communication so they can make a profit off of the private communication you are producing. Coombit is a worker cooperative trying to help small organizations or individuals get their email, website creation, and website hosting services off corporate services such as Google. For more information, contact us at coombit.org or email at info@coombit.org. That's K-O-U-M-B-I-T. We are not on Facebook.
Baby presents a Victoria Weekend Barbecue, Saturday, May 21st, noon till 8 p.m. at Mackenzie King Park, corner of Côte St. Catherine and Westbury. On the menu, pork and chicken, barbecue, jerk, and roti. Curry goat, saltfish, breadfruit and saltfish, also sides, homemade juices, and sweet treats. All plates, $15 or less. So come on out and enjoy the outside with Fabi and the crew. Music by DJ Jason. Saturday, May 21st at Mackenzie King Park.
Êtes-vous locataire à Montréal? Avez-vous des questions sur vos droits? Votre comité logement peut vous aider. Pour trouver le comité logement pour votre quartier ou pour plus de ressources, visitez le www.rclalq.qc.ca.
Pangea de Futura is a mega jam collective comprised of many veterans of the Montreal music scene. A wide range of tectonic plates coming together, making the world stop for a second and ripping these continents apart. CKUT 90.3 FM is proud to present their concert in collaboration with CHYZ 94.3 on Sunday, May 22nd at 3 p.m. at the 38th Festival International de Musique Actuelle de Victoriaville. For all the details on the 38th FIMAV, visit fimav.qc.ca.
One Stop Caribbean Cuisine is the place to be. The best tasting food, West Indian food. Check it out.
334
St. Jacques Street.
The one and only.
Chef X are the best. Everyone calling up his name, talking about him.
All type of food ready right there.
Fish, vegetable,
oxtail,
curry goat,
jerk chicken.
That same tasting Caribbean food in a Montreal. And then me go when me left Jamaica.
Go there right now. The food delicious.
Delicious.
West Indian Caribbean Cuisine.
I will be there. Check it out. Check it out.
Noam Chomsky, speaking from MIT. You're listening to
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Here we go, yo. Here we go, yo. Here we go. Here we go, yo. Here we go, yo. Here we go, yo. Here we go, yo. Here we go, yo.
Watch this. Here we go again. You want a friend? Booming in your Jeep like it ain't no thing. Uptown, downtown, all around town. Driving, booming, and listening to the sound of the SERWECHY. Music sweet, you pump it up higher. I spy, what do I spy? Fly girls as you're passing by. Walking, rocking while the system pump. Not crisscross, but you make them jump to the beat while booming up the street in your Jeep. Dance.